You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Trumped edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, our panel discusses the Paris climate deal and the rise of Donald Trump, the politician. Let's begin episode 326.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Joining me today in the Radio Freethinker virtual studios is Gulid. Say hello, Gulid.
Hello, Freethinkers. Glad to be back.
And Nicholas. Say hello, Nicholas.
Hi, guys. Glad to be here.
And Matt. Say hi, Matt.
Say hi, Matt.
So, in our previous episodes, we covered a lot of, you know, top stories of 2015, science, news, what have you. And Matt got really annoyed at me. He came and said, hey, Don, I didn't get to participate in the science one, and I barely got in on the one about the news stories. And I wanted to have my own take on 2015. So to rectify that wrong to Matt himself, we are going to have the all-Matt special edition of Radio Free Thinker. So Matt, let's start off. What are some of the top stories of 2015 that you thought slipped through the cracks or was just so important you want to talk about them again?
All right, Don, why don't we start with number one? I myself fancy myself as somewhat of an environmentalist, and therefore I think one of the most important stories of 2015 is the Paris Agreements held in November and December of 2015. It was the 21st meeting talking about trying to keep the global rise of temperature below 2 degrees Celsius by the end of 2100. There's 195 countries present, and they all signed unanimously this agreement to try and cut these emissions by the end of 2100.
So there's some interesting things out of the climate change meeting as well, was the normal push for reducing the temperature rise from previous negotiations was 2 degrees above
pre-industrial levels.
Right. But now they've gone to 1.5.
They're trying to keep under the 2 degree, right? And now this, what they're saying is they're trying to meet the 1.5. So it's a 1.5 goal. It's kind of like they'll be happy with 2 degrees, but it's a 1.5 goal. Now, whether that's possible or not, we'll get into that in a minute.
So let's go into part of that right now, because one of the other interesting things is that, one, even if they do reach the 1.5, we are already suffering greatly from climate change as it is. And that even at 1.5, that's still going to be pretty harsh on the environment and climate in general, let alone the effects that we get with the, you know, superstorms, one that just hit the eastern United States just a couple of weeks ago, the dramatic increase in flooding. You know, the one thing I love was great was the switch from global warming, which it is technically, to climate change, because climate change better reflects that, sure, some areas will get hotter, other areas might get actually a little colder, but a lot of the weather will become much more dramatic than it was before. So we are changing the climate, not just increasing the temperature. What do you think is going to be some of the biggest impacts, even if they do reach these goals?
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head there, Don. The 1.5 is not really going to be an end game here, right? This is a goal that we're trying to hit. And I believe what we're trying to do is just to continue to reduce over time. As you mentioned, some areas are going to get warmer, some will get colder. One of these things that we're starting to see as well is the shift in the polar vortex, which traditionally was circular in nature across the Arctic Circle, but is becoming much more of a wibbly-wobbly line here and there, motion. So that's why we're getting such extreme storms on the East Coast, because this polar vortex is shooting lower and thus bringing that cold air down. So that's one of the things that we're scared of. Additionally, I think one of the worst things is the rise in ocean temperatures as well, and how what the effect that's going to have on marine wildlife, especially coral reefs, if we don't physically destroy them right away. So yes, there's going to be there's more atrocities to come in terms of the issues with climate change, but the 1.5, which according to these goals, they're trying to hit. However, a lot of research says they're not going to hit, but either way, it is a step in the right direction.
So Matt, that's very interesting, but you know, a lot of people have complained that we're not going to make the goal. I mean, one of the big things was these are not, how should we put, written in stone. These are more aspirational. There's no binding agreement on that. And that's sadly because the Americans said, listen, if you want us to be part of it, there's not a hope in hell we're going to get this through as a treaty through the Congress. So you have to make this sort of voluntary. So again, more aspirational. But that makes it seem much more difficult to actually achieve these goals if no one's really going to be held accountable. Matt, so what exactly do you mean not being able to reach these goals?
Well, so I guess I should kind of clarify essentially what happens for those who don't know. So essentially what happens from here on out is that each country sets their own goals on, you know, how to reduce deforestation, how to reduce temperatures, all that kind of stuff. They're known as INDCs. So essentially everyone sets their own path on how to reduce these goals. Now, as Don was mentioning, of course, the bigger countries don't really want to be held to anything. I mean, the USA famously stayed out of the Kyoto meetings, so that is part of it. Now, what I'm talking about, however, by not meeting these goals is that even though people, they're trying to do the best they can, okay, without this agreement, we were on a course to hit about 3.8 degrees by 2100. That was what we're on pace for. Now, with these goals, an estimate of what we can reduce it to is 2.7 by 2100. So that's something some external research has been done to find out if we did a very good job, will we actually be able to hit it? And it's looking like we're not actually going to be able to hit that too. So that's what I mean by them not actually being able to hit it. And it's true. Like you were saying, Don, we can't make it a treaty because the diplomats went to have these conversations and now they actually have to convince our governments to do it. And it comes down on us to make sure that we're holding our representatives of accountable, our governments accountable to these goals. You know, numbers like the EU wants to reduce their emissions by 40%, Brazil by 37%, U.S. by 26%. All these numbers, it's kind of here and there, and we're just kind of hoping that it'll happen. But we really have to keep this accountability up.
Nicholas, I'm kind of interesting. Interested in your view. One of the things that is seen as an achievement of this is that, you know, you have the Americans, the Chinese, the Indians, all sort of getting together and, again, agreeing to, if aspirational, but agreeing to these goals. And that's something that's sort of new, that, you know, that you're going to have countries like China, which have been known to be one of the countries that have sort of said, well, listen, the West, you guys had the chance to develop your economy by going through fossil fuels like there's no tomorrow. And now that our economies are beginning to develop, you're saying, oh, no, you can't have that advantage because you'll destroy the environment. What do you think is the impact that China has actually bought into the whole climate change? We got to reduce it.
I think many developing countries, they're putting a lot of effort into, you know, fighting climate change, especially China, because I ever since I was really little, government propaganda was all about, you know, planting more trees, you know, stop polluting the air, stop polluting the river, that kind of stuff. Whether or not they actually do it is a different story, but the government put in a lot of effort to, you know, spread the words, make sure everybody understands how important it is to keep the climate as stable as possible. I'm still a little bit skeptical about the entire Paris Treaty because again, fighting climate change is a very, very complex procedure. And then you just give a number, 1.5 degrees, and how much does each country have to contribute? You know, there's still a lot of things need to work out. If not, then the entire treaty would be useless. So I guess we have to put in a lot of effort to figure out what exactly should do in order to make this come true, including finding the perfect balance with developing and developed countries.
Now, Matt, you mentioned that one of the big things about this is, you know, you could do the naming and shaming. And actually, one of the things I've heard quite a bit about, but I must admit, I don't know much of the details. I'm not sure if you do either, is that the one of the emphasis was on the idea of openness, is that, you know, all the efforts to reduce greenhouse gases, all of the actual total emissions and all that was going to be very much made out and open. And that was the one thing you could kind of get all countries to buy in on. What are your thoughts on the idea that, you know, well, one, is it going to be really as transparent as they claim? And two, do you think that will really have the power necessary to even make the 2.7 goal that you had mentioned a reality?
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say transparency because that's exactly how they put it. And it's a tough one because as someone, I like to be positive. That is definitely one thing I like to see. And I believe that depending on the leader, if we do put enough pressure, it will do its job. Like if it is something that we need to maintain. And I believe over time, especially right now and where we are, more and more and more people and more countries and cultures are putting pressure on us as a whole, as a society, as a species, to focus on our environment, to focus on this one planet that we have. I believe this transparency will work, and I think the fact is of the matter is I have to believe that. Otherwise, for me, it's just too bleak of a reality, because I do understand that things can get pushed in the wayside because, I mean, us as a society, sometimes we don't focus on the main points. I think that's your radio show follows these points, but I don't think a lot of people will. They've kind of buried their head in the sand here. So I am hoping this transparency works, but we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, I find it quite depressing at times when I sit there and I look at my alternative news sources and, you know, they're talking about, you know, well, right now there's the methane gas leak that's in California right now, which is increasing California's greenhouse gas emissions by 25%, which, I mean, wow, that is. And there's nothing they can do to stop it until, well, for another month or two. And it's just blowing methane straight into the atmosphere. And although that's not nearly as long term a bad thing as carbon dioxide, in the short term, it's a much worse greenhouse gas unit. And I guess I'll open this up to the floor to anyone who wants to do it, to do the other, what's the word, plan B. There's been a lot of talk lately about the idea of geoengineering, that if you could just somehow reduce the amount of solar energy that reaches the Earth, or you could somehow reflect more of it back into space, that's one way we can kind of solve climate change without having to sort of solve the underlying addiction to fossil fuels. And for those of you who don't know, geoengineering is the idea that we can somehow come up with some kind of technological fix to solve climate change. So one of the interesting aspects is to increase the amount of aerosols in the upper atmosphere so that we reflect more energy back out into space. So with less solar energy hitting the surface of the planet, there will be less greenhouse warming. Another alternative that I've heard about is where you have this sort of massive fleet of mist makers that travel the oceans, creating low-level clouds. And the idea of them, again, to reflect more solar radiation back into space, thus reducing the degree or at least the amount of heating that happens in climate change. Some other ideas that are a bit more down to earth, so to speak, is the idea of like carbon capture or creating particular mechanical devices that will literally take the carbon out of the atmosphere and sequester it somewhere. Now, these devices have had two basic ideas. Is one, you know, oh shit, we need to do this because if we don't, we're going to have 10 degrees above and it's too late to solve anything. So we need to do these radical climate, these radical engineering projects on a global scale to save the planet. So with that idea of what sort of geoengineering is, at least in this particular way, what do you guys think about it as a possibility of being Plan B?
Well, I think for any project in that scale, it's definitely going to cost a lot of money. And then, again, the cost of reducing the temperature rise by 1.5 degrees might actually be, you know, cheaper than inventing some cloud system that can reflect solar radiations. So I'm not sure how exactly they're going to figure it out, but it does sound like a very big project. And also, what kind of a byproduct those technology will bring to Earth? You know, what if we can't control the amount of cloud we created? What if we can't control the amount of carbon dioxide we absorb from the atmosphere? And then what if we do too much? And then now the climate going to become colder or going to have other byproducts coming out of it. So it's a tricky, but unless we absolutely need it, I think there must be other ways around it.
Gulit, I guess I have an interesting question for you then. Most of the geoengineering projects seem to be global in nature, but there's nothing stopping individual nations from doing these things. And if a country does this in order to change the climate, well, it just doesn't change its own climate. It changes everyone's climate. What are the ethical implications of the idea, let's say Canada wanted to seed the ocean with iron in order to increase carbon capture? Well, that's great that Canada wants to do that, but we're also kind of bringing everyone else in on this experiment. And who knows, as Nicholas says, who knows what might be some of the side effects?
I do see that as an ethical dilemma. I think there needs to be a dialogue between the country that wants to experiment and, you know, the countries that would be affected, which is pretty much everyone. But at the same time, I don't think any one country should have the authority, no matter, you know, if their heart is in the right place, sort of trying to stop the progression of climate change and improve the climate on Earth, there should still be communication to all the other countries. And there should definitely be a dialogue between these countries.
Do you think there would be a casus belli, let's say, if China started diverting the water from the headwaters of some of the major rivers that normally would go into India, Bangladesh, Nepal, and diverted that towards China because, again, climate change, maybe they're not getting as much water, there's more drought. Do you think a country would have a right to attack another country for doing something like that?
Sorry, but isn't this the basis behind the movie Mad Max? The water wars?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is a very large potential of the future is war over water. I mean, that's essentially what that part of it is talking about. So
Matt, do you think in excluding the movie, do you think a country would have casus belli to declare war if a country did something like that in their near future?
I don't know if they have a right to, but I can see it being an inevitability. I think there will most likely be diplomatic options in the future to avoid that kind of aspect, but not 100% necessarily is that a truth, because, I mean, we all know that wars are fought over commodities and wars are fought over land and usage and things like that, and if one country decides that the water is more important for them, then... Well, wouldn't be surprised if, you know, bombs start to fly.
So here comes then a follow-up to that. Do you think, let's pretend that India, for one reason or another, says, screw it, we're going to burn as much fossil fuel as we possibly can, to hell with what might happen to the climate. Would any nation have casus belli to attack India to try and prevent it from destroying the climate for everyone else.
I believe that would be more of an economic attack than anything else. I believe that as sanctions, like a global, on a global scale, because of what India themselves have agreed to. India said themselves that they would be promoting and investing in clean energy. So, for instance, if it was India or even another country, I think as because of the recent talks in Paris, that there would be repercussions economically for that. Whether that can be truly held up is questionable, but I think an economic attack might be something that is possible.
So what do you think about the idea then that, you know, sure, climate change is going to suck for the Americans because the great wheat belt and that of Texas and all that's going to turn into a dust bowl. We here in Canada, we're going to have it great because, you know, as the climate becomes warmer, what used to grow in the mid and southern states will now grow in southern Canada, but northern Canada will now have this great opportunity to be the breadbasket of the world. I mean, it's not all negatives.
No, that is true, but I believe the negatives outweigh the positives, inevitably. So, yes, it's great. We'll be able to, I don't know what, grow our strawberries, oranges, whatever California.
Blueberries.
Is that, yeah, whatever almonds. It might be. Almonds. I could definitely go for some local almonds, but I think what's more important is maintaining the environmental status quo. And I believe no one has an issue with that. I mean, unless you're, I don't know, Donald Trump, who doesn't believe in it or something.
So, Matt, you said that Paris was one of the top stories of the year, and you've laid out some of the reasons. What are your final thoughts about, you know, the Paris conference? This is the 21st climate change conference that they've had. And arguably, the only real big thing that came out of this was, one, everyone agreed climate change was sort of real, which they kind of did in Kyoto, although some did backsies afterwards. And they have this big transparency thing. So what else should we have as a takeaway from Paris?
I think the fact that everyone agreed to make their own goals and to review them. You know, they are meeting again in 2018 and to assess how to achieve the first steps of their goals. I think the fact that organization in these countries is starting to become a thing, is starting to become a reality, I should say, is a beautiful thing, is just fantastic, knowing that these 195 countries are making committees, or are at least saying they're going to, in order to make these goals and try and make them a reality. I think the second thing here that is really important and we haven't mentioned yet is that quote-unquote rich countries, I don't know, I didn't look into exactly which ones, are going to be helping developing countries meet these goals by investing $100 billion per year by 2020. Whether this becomes a reality or not, I think the fact that quote-unquote promises have been made because of these goals and because of this act of generosity, I think these are two amazing things. And I also believe that the reactions, I guess, on the in the news and on the internet have been so positive. I think this is a really good thing and a really good thing for our future.
So Matt, we talked about geoengineering. Did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I believe geoengineering is 100% necessary to somewhat of a degree. There are amazing technologies currently being developed in order to aid in these things. So genetically modified organisms to potentially produce more oxygen and take in more carbon dioxide would be great. Additionally, one that I know of specifically, I don't know if this means geoengineering, but there's a company working on a large-scale duct system. So they would take in carbon dioxide, convert that actually into a fuel, and use that as a carbon fuel source, and it would actually reduce amount of carbon dioxide in the air. So I think that geoengineering, to somewhat of a degree, is very necessary. And I think if we follow the correct scientific process to ensure that it's not going to create an issue further down the road, it's something that we should definitely look into.
And while we look down the road, let's take a bit of a break.
Making a cuppa? Stop! How many cups of tea are you making? What? There's enough for 10 cups in there. Only boil the amount of water that you actually need. Very good, old boy.
That's right. The British are making less tea to conserve energy. Students can conserve energy, too.
A student's life often follows a pattern. Eat, sleep, study. During this routine, don't forget to make time for energy conservation. This will be the easiest thing you do all semester, and a little bit goes a long way. Do your laundry in cold water and hang clothes on standing dry racks or clotheslines instead of using electricity-intensive dryers. If a dryer is the only option, throw in a dry towel with wet clothes to absorb moisture and cut down on drying time.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9.
Hi, my name's Matthew. When I first got back from a military tour in Afghanistan, anytime I heard a siren or even a car alarm, I'd lose it completely. I would turn into a wild man, screaming, waving my arms. People would yell at me, "Shut up, you crazy. Get a job, would ya?" Well, I didn't go out and get a job. I got help instead. Now, I'm in a clean and safe apartment. I have friends and helpers who understand me. I landed a decent job, but I gotta admit, I still don't like car alarms or sirens. I used to think mental illness was a death sentence. I got life instead.
This message was produced by Columbian Center Society and Radio Malaspina in British Columbia.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, your completely transparent, skeptical show on CITR 101.9 FM. And we're back. We just finished talking about the impact and import of the Paris Climate Change Deal. Now, prepare to be trumped. So Matt, now that you got things off to a hot start, see, get the climate change.
Nailed it, Don.
What is your next top story from 2015?
So, my next topic is a lot easier to introduce. All I need to say is the rise of Trump. I think we all know where it began and how it's moved from the beginning of in the middle of this year. The fear that from many countries that Trump might actually get into office is what he's been saying is something that I think needs to be discussed at some point. And I think it's a fan favorite.
So, Matt, let's start off with, who is Donald Trump?
Donald Trump is a toupee model. So Donald Trump is a multi-billionaire. He is a man who has his own organization, his own company, so to speak. And he is, I mean, I don't really need to introduce the man, but he is running for president in the United States this year. He is in the Iowa race, I believe, as well. He is also a man of many words, so to speak, as he steps over the lines of what is believed to be politically correct in a lot of ways. However, he is doing very well currently in the Republican polls. I mean, what else needs to be said about the man?
Trump has declared bankruptcy a few times, and he keeps touting his brilliance for business. But really, most of the money that Trump makes is actually by licensing his name. So he's done very good to create the character of Donald Trump. What was it? I was just reading that Forbes estimated his net value about $4 billion. In his financial statements, he states that his, well, it's called real estate licensing deal brand and branded developments, which is basically Trump, the name, is valued at $3.3 billion. So almost all his net worth is in selling himself. And he has done that quite well. But another very interesting thing about Trump is that, honestly, Trump started out as a Democrat, right? I mean, he was, you know, he was in favor of abortion. He was very liberal on most of his stance. He's always, of course, you know, big on the rich. He didn't have their money taken from him. But But he's evolved quite a bit over the years. And it's funny that he is actually running as an outsider in the Republican race for presidency. Another weird thing has happened is, I mean, when Trump first came out and announced his candidacy, everyone said, it's a buffoon, it's a joke. He'll be like all the others. He'll have his, you know, 1 week of fame and then he'll disappear into nothing. But give the devil his due. He has managed to parlay this spark of possibility and has fanned a huge flame that may actually see him become the nominee for the Republican Party. So much so that the other boogeyman that's running in the Republican race is Ted Cruz. And basically, a lot of people say, well, you know, Donald Trump has the aura of being a megalomaniac and will destroy the company, but he's not really that kind of person. Ultimately, he's a businessman, and if he does get somehow elected to be president, he'll actually kind of try and do the work that a president should do, even if it's not the way that you would think it done. Whereas Ted Cruz is well, he is the Hitler. He is the Mussolini. He is much more methodical. He's much more ideologue. He's much more willing to do anything if it goes along with his ideas. And they're pretty radical ideas. And a sign of that has been, again, in recent weeks, you've had the, quote, establishment Republicans come out and say, well, listen, if it's between Trump and Cruz, it's got to be Trump. Because, like I say, at least he's the sane one, which I think has also been a very bizarre turn of events. Gula, Nicholas, do you guys have any ideas on this?
I think we just got rid of a Canadian dictator-like figure. I wouldn't want to see another one sitting in such a high form of power.
You know, one interesting fact about Donald Trump is, I know he mentioned this a lot, but he is a very smart guy. You know, his autobiography is one of my to-read list. So I heard he did a really good job in that autobiography. And a lot of people were actually amazed by some of the strategy he used to gain his fame and his money. Whether or not there are the best ways or they're legal or they are appropriate, he is a very smart man to manipulate, you know, the laws, the system. So I can see him as a very good businessman, but I don't see him as a politician who can benefit America or the world.
Now, there's one caveat I should throw into here, that we are recording this the night before the Iowa caucuses. So much of this may be much ado of nothing, but it still rates as a phenomenon in 2015 worthwhile of a mention. So listeners, bear that in mind if this seems a little of a weird conversation to have after Trump gets assassinated or what have you. So that being said, let's go into some of the things that Donald Trump says and what does that say about the even though he's getting about 25% support from Republicans themselves, he's getting almost double that in what they call undecided. And those are people who don't claim to be Republican or Democrat, but their vote is up to grab for whoever wants it. And he's polling really, really well with them as well. So one of the things that's one of his trademarks is, and Matt, you kind of alluded to it, I think, is his willingness to say things that others won't say. Like, let's ban all the Muslims from coming to the country. Mexicans are thieves and they're rapists. I mean, the racist rhetoric that comes out from him is it's scary that this is a presidential candidate that says such divisive things and such, well, racist things. I mean, Matt, you must have some opinion about this.
Oh, boy. Do I ever. He is a piece of work. He's a fearmonger. He is a peddler to the masses. He is one of the best salesmen out there. He is a brander. He is someone who knows how to make a brand and has done so. We were talking about how good of a businessman he is, and he does that. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the things he says are horrible, and yet they make their way through America. I think as Canadians and as very left people, we don't understand it. We don't understand how the man can say this kind of stuff I mean, one of the things he said is this very expensive global warming bullshit has got to stop. Our planet is freezing, record low temperatures, and our GW scientists are stuck in ice. Like, first of all, none of that is true. I mean, 2015 was the hottest year on record. And yet he's peddling to these people who are ill-informed. And I think this is an ongoing issue in the States. And he peddles to that incredibly well, even though he is patronizing, patriarchal, and sexist, all this kind of stuff. It seems to be a lot of things that are going over well in this weird congregation of strange people known as the United States of America.
So another weird thing about this is, how do I put this, that as terrible as Trump is, he's still to the left of Ted Cruz. So let us all remember when we're castigating against about Trumpism, that he's not the worst man in the room, but he's pretty close to it. One of the things I found very disturbing, and it's almost as if it was in response to some of the comments made. There was a period of time where people were trying to make the analogy between Trump and Mussolini or Hitler, and how that wasn't a very, you know, sure, they both were demagogues in the sense of being able to rile up the people and using hate as a mechanism of support. But Trump, you know, didn't have any brown shirts or black shirts. And I think we talked about that even on the show. And that's quite true. But then it started showing up that at his rallies, whenever there was anyone that was trying to protest, however silently or peacefully, that people were starting to get beat up at his rallies. And you had this sort of milieu of brown shirts starting to come to force. Now, again, I do think it is way overblown to make the connection between Trump and Hitler or Mussolini. But you see this continual radicalization of the American political system, mainly on the right, very little on the left. But what do you guys think about this drive to the insane that you see, especially in the Republican race?
I think this is a time in history that is unprecedented, and I think everyone agrees with that. There's just so much going on. And I think in America, where I feel like we're also going to agitate some people on this show. But I think in, let's say, some places in America, I don't want to say brainwashing, but almost to the fact that that's a reality. So some of the things you're seeing on Fox News, if we go for kind of a very extreme example, is all about this, like you were saying, Don, insanity push or push towards the uninformed, where we want to say things like, you know, this global warming thing, is it a real thing? Or, you know, this terrorism thing, it's a real thing. Things along those lines. I think it's has to do with the entertainment of the people who actually owns the media, which you've probably talked about here before. But because of that, in the mainstream media, and because that's what a lot of people in these very rural states see, and because they're pushed that way or since they were born, such as in Alberta, where people are just grown up to vote conservative in general. That's what I should say. Donald Trump, as I was saying, he peddled to that. He maintains this insanity push in the media. He maintains this fear that they've been pushing. He maintains this environmentalism is wrong because it's costing us too much money and things like that, or it's fake or whatever it might be because the media is saying so. I don't know. It's interesting. Let's just go with that.
One of the things I think that ties into this, and this is where we'll bring in Bernie Sanders, is this appeal to people who are suffering. Now, Sanders is sitting there saying, listen, you're suffering because we have a judicial system that is really, really run against you. If you're poor, if you're a minority, you're really going to get short end of the stick. And, you know, you're worried about losing your jobs because they're giving tax breaks to billionaires while at the same time exporting anything possibly work-related to China, Vietnam, where have you. There's this race to the bottom, the evaporation of the middle class. Sanders is saying, you're in a real bad place, and the people you should be blaming are the 1%, the fat cats on Wall Street, and the people who paid for and bought the government of the United States. It's a very interesting stat where they did a poll that basically said, what kinds of things do you want Washington to do? And they divided up based on socioeconomic classes. And they found that the top 10%, the things they wanted to get done, 95% of those were done by Washington. Whereas the bottom 90%, basically 1% to 2% of the things they wanted to get done actually got done. There was this huge discrepancy as to who politicians are actually listening to. And you get the same kind of thing now going on with the right. I mean, you had the Tea Party thing and Donald Trump, but the ultimate outsider. He's never held the government office. He has no idea how to do anything in government. The same people who are supporting him are the same people who said, listen, the system isn't working for me. I'm getting screwed over. This needs to change. Now, unlike Sanders, he's not blaming the people who I think are the true cause of it. He's taking the easier road and demonizing Muslims, immigrants, anyone who is sort of a progressive bent. What do you think of that whole idea that in many ways, the people who are supporting Sanders and who are supporting Trump are really the same kind of people? It's just they've had their pain manipulated in different ways. What do you guys think of that? And anyone can jump in here. Gulid, Nicholas?
I think regardless of who you are or how informed you are, we do to some degree realize that there's a huge income and wealth disparity between the 1% and the majority, and not much has been done about it. So I can see how a lot of people are more appealed to Donald Trump's approach, which is, like you said, demonizing Muslims and Mexicans. It's a lot easier to do. You're not really addressing anything. You're just sort of demonizing a specific group of people. And I think it's really interesting just to see how many people find Donald Trump appealing. I did not think he would make it this far, to be honest. It's weird because politicians are normally, I don't want to say trained, but are supposed to act in a specific way. They're not supposed to have such like blatant views, and it's just really uncommon. There's a lot of shock value to what he says. So I didn't think he would make it this far, to be honest.
I think one of the strategy that Donald Trump uses is to showcase how successful he is. You know, he constantly mentioned that he's really rich. You know, he can make his company rich, therefore he can make the country rich. So that's the one strategy he uses, I think, to really showcase the Americans how smart he is, and then he can make everybody rich and happy. But whether or not that's going to be true, or all depending on how the election results turn out.
One of the things, well, actually, and I'm going to direct this towards you, Nicholas, because you are, well, I won't say you're a Trump supporter, but you definitely have positive things to say about him. And this isn't limited to Trump, so I'm not even trying to pick on him in general. But I noticed the complete absence of fact-checking / accountability. That one of the things that Trump had said was that he remembers being in New York where thousands of Muslims were cheering the Twin Towers falling down. And he said many other things that are just factually wrong. Either he lied or he was just wrong. And again, he's not the only one who's doing it. And there seems to be no accountability in American politics to sit there and not speak the truth. You think they'd get called out on this. So do you think Donald Trump lies on purpose, like as part of his strategy? Or why do you think he can get away with it?
Absolutely. I think just as any other businessman, or most of the business people, lies are one of the common tools they use. They need to lie to get whatever they need. I think that's one of the strategy he used during his campaign. He's saying that he knows the system, he knows how to manipulate the system, and then he can lie about it, and nobody can do anything about it. But I think that's really, you know, because since no one really can say anything, or even his lying, then no one really can do anything about him. So, Yeah.
So you're for Trump lies.
I don't support Trump's, Donald Trump, but I think that he's a very interesting person.
So, Matt, I guess Nicholas kind of gave a weak but, you know, positive defense as to why Trump would lie and, you know, what benefits he may attribute to that. But why do the American people, why does the media let him away with it? I mean, I may be wrong in this, but I don't think you could get away with it, at least to the same degree, here in Canada. I mean, some of the things that came up in the election were basically, no, you're wrong about that, and people knew you were wrong, and that came back to bite the Conservatives' ass. So why do you think the Americans let them get away with it?
I think I was mentioning about the media, the nature of the media in the United States is it's owned, right? It's things like Fox, it's owned by this class of people who are very right wing, and they have the ability to force that that hand of the American public. So they support the war in the Middle East. They are anti environmentalism, things like that. But also, the media in general in the United States is very, like I said, fear-mongering. So they're letting him make these lies because they are wanting the people to fear all these kinds of things. I it's hard to say because this is just speculation on my part. Really, to me, it's a form of culture insanity. But I think what you were mentioning in Canada, why it was easier to call Harper out on his lies, was because our country, the large populations are centered in more educated, I guess, areas. So you've got masses in Toronto's and Vancouver, and so that's where a lot of the media is, the mainstream media is. That's where a lot of the informed voters are and things like that. So it's a lot easier to call out these kinds of lies. However, you have this massive population in the United States that's spread everywhere, and you have this racist culture or fear culture in these spread out states, in these rural areas, and they want to hear these lies, and the media wants to feed these lies. So there are definitely outlets that are trying to show the people, hey, this is not even close to true. I think anywhere you look on the internet, all you see is he's lying to you. So I find that, I think we'll find that a lot of the younger voters and a lot of the more educated about the policies will probably not vote that direction because he's been lying to us. Or lying to the American people. But people who are only fed one right-wing form of media, they're going to be forced to vote for him in a certain way.
Yeah, I agree with Matt. I think a lot of people, they chose to believe him, although in the deep consciousness, they think it's a lie. Just because, you know, there's a vast amount of people in America who are anti-Muslim, who are anti-Mexican, and then they choose to believe what Donald Trump is saying.
The X-File effect. I want to believe.
Exactly.
Matt, I'm kind of curious to know your take on the comment I made that the core supporters of Sanders and Trump are the same kind of people. You know, they're both people who are down and out and knocked out, and, you know, they're desperately grasping for change, and they see Sanders and Trump as being anti-establishmentarianist. What are your thoughts?
First of all, I love that word. But second of all, I think you are right, and I think you're onto it, and I believe that what Trump is blaming the government, he's blaming that, you know, those people, they don't know what they're doing, so I'm going to change things the way that business should be done, blah, blah, blah. But Bernie Sanders is talking about real reform and going in the direction of a, how is he putting it, socialist democracy?
Democratic socialism.
democratic socialism. So that's the direction he wants to take it. And so he's you're absolutely right. He's blaming the one percenters and how that's going. And then Donald Trump is using that fear as well. So I would completely agree with you. But I think Donald Trump uses more of the fear-mongering as well. Bernie Sanders is trying to be a lot more politically educated and going in a, you know, these kinds of reforms work well.
We would call that evidence-based policy.
Thank you. Evidence-based policy. And Donald Trump is just going for, I guess, political popularity is what he's going for.
One of the things that's actually stunning is that he has very little as far as actual policy. It's like, well, how are you going to bring the country's economy back up to par? I'll just do it. How are you going to solve things with Russia? I'll sit down and I'll have a talk with the guy. So he's not actually even bringing out of anything that he will do. It's just like, I'm the man for the spot. Just trust me.
Yeah. And, you know, he's talking about these tax cuts. He's like, you know, less money needs to go to the government. You know, it's you guys, you're hard fought. You need to keep it. But people say that the taxes cut over the next decade, if they are static, would be close to $12 trillion. And that's about $10 trillion if you account for economic growth and increases in supply and that nature. But how are you going to balance budgets and how are you going to reduce deficits if you have no tax revenue?
So this leads now to another. This is pure speculation because I love speculative history. I have noticed recently, and by recently the last decade or three, a decline in American empire, that you're seeing the more and more radicalization of its politics, the disenfranchisement of its people. I mean, one of the things that was brilliant about FDR and the American form of capitalism is that although it allowed capitalism to run free, it managed to use its democratic process as sort of a pressure valve. So even if, you know, it was very unequal and that sort of thing, you had at least the people had the feeling that they were in control, and that would prevent, you know, economic revolution or political revolution. But I see more and more of those avenues being cut down and the pressures building up more and more. What do you think are the chances that Donald Trump, okay, maybe Donald Trump isn't Hitler or Mussolini, maybe not even Ted Cruz, but they are pushing the boundary in that direction. What do you think is the likelihood of something like that happening in the United States? Well, within your lifetimes.
Unfortunately, fairly well. It's hard to say, but I mean, this radicalism is occurring more and more right now. I mean, let me take that back a little bit. I wouldn't say it's incredibly high, and it's just not outside the realm of possibility. And I think there's a potential depending on how our planet goes. And I think we were talking about climate change earlier. If things get incredibly bad in the United States because of these environmental changes, things are going to get a lot more radical a lot faster. I mean, if we do relate to what we've talked about in the past, climate change was a factor in the creation of ISIS. And so with radical changes to lifestyle, might become more radicalism in the government. And I mean, right now you have two incredibly separated presidential candidates in Trump/Ted Cruz, which are incredibly on the right. And then you have Bernie Sanders, who's literally calling himself partially socialist. So we're already starting to see radicalism, and we'll see what happens over, you know, hopefully a long lifetime.
A lot of people don't realize, too, that in the Weimar Republic, in the lead up to Hitler's rise, there was a strong battle between, well, then it was the communists and the fascists, but there was radicalization on both the left and the right. And it was the establishment that sort of bet on Hitler that, you know, we can control this guy. Yeah, he's a demagogue, but he's just like any other politician. We can control him. And obviously they were proven wrong in that. But you had that same sort of left-right radicalization that I see happening in the United States. I mean, Gulen and I, we've talked about Black Lives Matter and how at a certain point there's going to be – well, they're talking about this already in Chicago of just getting rid of the police force, that it is too broke to fix. And when I heard that, I thought, well, that's nuts. You need to have some sort of police system. But if you live in a society where you literally think it is better to have no cops, that the crooks should just go on their own and communities will police themselves, that's somehow better than having the police. That shows you how far down the rabbit hole they must have gotten. So maybe before we go down that road about that kind of radicalization, just to wrap up the Trump part, Matt, you brought it up. What do you think are the chances of him actually being nominated as the Republican candidate for president? And if that happens, what do you think of his chances of actually winning vis-a-vis Hillary or Sanders?
Well, Don, I actually think his chances are very high right now. I think you were mentioning about Ted Cruz being very radical, and he is very radical. Donald is unfortunately the better choice right now between the two, and they are the leaders. I do, however, believe that whoever is on the left will be a better choice, and the American public will see that. Whether the country is ready for Bernie Sanders, that is yet to be seen. But I think that Hillary does have a better chance. If she makes it in or Sanders makes it in, I think they have a better chance because I believe that the voters will see through Donald Trump, whether it is sooner or later.
And I believe in unicorns. And on that very uplifting note, it's time for us to say goodbye. Say goodbye, Gulen.
Take care, free thinkers. And remember, different skins, but all the same within.
Say goodbye, Nicholas.
Goodbye, guys. Remember to keep thinking.
Say goodbye, Matt.
Goodbye, everyone. And remember to stay open, stay positive, and stay healthy.
We're going to end with Bernie Sanders explaining to CNN what a democratic socialist is. And as always, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you call yourself a democratic socialist, how can any kind of socialist win a general election in the United States?
Well, we're going to win because first we're going to explain what democratic socialism is. And what democratic socialism is about is saying that it is immoral and wrong that the top 0.1% in this country own almost 90%. Almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. That it is wrong today in a rigged economy that 57% of all new income is going to the top 1%. That when you look around the world, you see every other major country providing health care to all people as a right, except the United States. You see every other major country saying to moms that when you have a baby, we're not going to separate you from your newborn baby because we are going to have, medical and family paid leave like every other country on earth. Those are some of the principles that I believe in. And I think we should look to countries like Denmark, like Sweden and Norway and learn from what they have accomplished for their working people.
Denmark is a country that has a population of 5.6 million people. The question is really about electability here, and that's what I'm trying to get at. The Republican Attack Act against you in a general election, it writes itself. You supported the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, you honeymooned in the Soviet Union, and just this weekend you said you're not a capitalist. Doesn't that ad write itself?
Well, first of all, let's look at the facts. The facts that are very simple. Republicans win when there is a low voter turnout, and that is what happened last November. 63% of the American people didn't vote, Anderson. 80% of young people didn't vote. We are bringing out huge turnouts and creating excitement all over this country. Democrats at the White House on down will win when there is excitement and a large voter turnout, and that is what this campaign is doing.
You don't consider yourself a capitalist, though.
Do I consider myself part of the casino capitalist process by which so few have so much and so many have so little, by which Wall Street's greed and recklessness wreck this economy? No, I don't. I believe in a society where all people do well, not just a handful of billionaires.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.